WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Motown songwriting team of Brian Holland, Lamont Dozier, and Edward Holland. Tomorrow, they'll be honored with the BMI Icon Award at BMI's annual Pop Awards dinner. Holland, Dozier, and Holland wrote songs for the Supremes, the Four Tops, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, and Marvin Gaye. Songs like You Can't Hurry Love, Baby Love, Reach Out, I'll Be There, Can't Help Myself, Heat Wave, and How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You. Also, we remember Boston Globe reporter Elizabeth Newfer. She had covered several wars. She died in a car accident on Friday in Iraq, where she was covering the aftermath of the war. She had joined us several times in the past few months to talk about Iraq and Iran. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Three explosions have been reported in the Saudi capital, Riyadh, at least one of them at expatriate housing compounds for Westerners. The blast came on the eve of Secretary of State Colin Powell's visit there. There are reports of casualties. NPR's Michelle Kellerman is traveling with Powell.
Diplomatic sources say the bombs went off at three separate locations, all apparently targeting American housing compounds in the Saudi capital. Saudi Arabia has been the scene of anti-American attacks in the past, including the 1996 Khobar Towers bombing that killed 19 Americans. The latest attack comes just hours before Secretary of State Colin Powell's planned visit. He's due to ask the Saudis for their help in cracking down on militant groups and promoting a new Israeli-Palestinian peace initiative. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Amman.
Diplomatic sources say there are no plans at the moment to change Powell's travel schedule. The secretary is on a tour of the Middle East in an effort to raise support for the so-called roadmap to peace.
We all agreed once again that we need to take this moment. We need to seize this moment of opportunity that we have in the region with the end of the regime of Saddam Hussein and with the president's new commitment, determined commitment, to move the peace process forward in the area.
Powell's stops today included Egypt, where the foreign minister complained that Israel has not formally accepted the roadmap. President Bush is on a three-state tour to promote his $550 billion tax cut proposal. During a stop in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the president called for the elimination of the tax on corporate dividends.
Getting rid of the double taxation of dividends will encourage more companies to pay dividends, will encourage more ownership, will help ease the cost of capital, and will serve as good and positive corporate reform in America. Congress needs to get rid of the double taxation of dividends.
The president's trip came as a much smaller tax cut plan was being debated in the Senate. Senator Max Baucus, a Montana Democrat, complained that the president's plan for dividends was too costly.
The president's proposal on dividends, it's troubling for many of us. It must be either eliminated or even more dramatically scaled down. Yes, the tax treatment of dividends might be a worthy subject as part of a budget-neutral corporate tax reform debate, but the president's dividend proposal at roughly $400 billion is simply too fiscally irresponsible.
Senator Max Baucus of Montana. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 122 points, or 1.4%, to close at 8,726 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 21 points, or 1.3%. It closed at 1,541. The S&P 500 gained 11 points to close at 945. This is NPR News. The new civil administrator has taken over the reconstruction effort in Iraq. Former Ambassador Paul Bremer will succeed retired General Jay Garner, who will now report to Bremer. State Department spokesman Philip Reeker denied that the staff changes in the reconstruction team are any sign of failure in the administration. The jockey who rode the winning horse in this month's Kentucky Derby has been cleared following an investigation into possible wrongdoing. Racing officials announced today that Jose Santos was not carrying an illegal device that could have made his horse go faster. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
The investigation by three horse racing stewards concluded jockey Jose Santos followed the rules of racing when he rode Funny Side to a surprise victory in the Kentucky Derby. The stewards launched their review after a photograph from the May 3rd race indicated Santos may have carried something in his hand other than a whip. Speculation focused on an electronic device that could have shocked the horse and made it go faster. But after studying still photos, videotapes, and race-related interviews, the stewards unanimously decided Santos only carried a whip. The controversy clouded the aftermath of horse racing's premier event. Funnyside shocked the field to become the first gelding to win the Derby in 74 years. Funnyside and Santos will compete in this weekend's Preakness Stakes, the second leg of racing's Triple Crown. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Military officials say U.S. forces have taken custody of two more former Iraqi officials. One is Ibrahim Ahmad Mohammed al-Tikriti, the former head of the Iraqi military. Also in custody is Dr. Rehab Rashid Taha, a British-trained microbiologist who's said by UN inspectors to have run a biological weapons program. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Cato Charitable Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial well-being.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The songwriting team of Holland, Dozier, and Holland helped define the Motown sound. Many of their songs are written for the Supremes and the Four Tops. Songs like You Can't Hurry Love, Baby Love, Where Did Our Love Go, Stop in the Name of Love, Reach Out, I'll Be There, I Can't Help Myself, Bernadette, and It's the Same Old Song. They also wrote Heatwave, How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You, and Mickey's Monkey. Brothers Brian and Eddie Holland, along with Lamont Dozier, will receive the BMI Icon Award tomorrow at the annual BMI Pop Awards dinner. I spoke with them about their Motown years. They left the label in 1968. Let's start with one of their big hits. Here's the Four Tops. Brian Holland, Lamont Dozier, Edward Holland, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on your BMI award. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we've just been listening to the Four Tops, Reach Out. In the intro, is that almost kind of like galloping horse drum beat? was that the idea of one of you?
Well, it was Lamont and I came up with, thought about that and which makes it interesting, different sounds like that makes a record interesting, especially on an intro.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The feeling of it, I think there was a broken tambourine. There was a tambourine without the little shakers on it. And we just thought that, the feeling of the music was, it almost dictated that we have some type of feeling like that going through that little galloping thing that you mentioned. And in this case, we found this broken tambourine that seemed to match just what we needed for that feeling,
Eddie Holland, you were the lyricist on this song. How did you come up with the Reach Out, I'll Be There hook?
I'm not sure. I think that was Lamont had the idea. Often when Brian and Lamont would work together on the basic melodies in the earlier stages, sometimes, one or two of us, or three of us would come up with an idea, and then they would give me, after they recorded the instrumentation in the studio, they would give me that tape of that, and I would have to write the lyric to it.
Wait, so you wrote the lyric after it was partially produced?
Well, yes. When you say, yeah, I guess you could consider it partially produced when the instrumentation was basically done, the rhythm of it. Then that's when Bryant would, because Bryant was the engineer also, in many cases, he would give me a copy of it. I sometimes, like I say, would have a title. Sometimes it wouldn't. But the bottom line is that I had to finish the lyric of it.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. So the song already had a feel to it. It had a sound before there was a lyric.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Most definitely.
Because mm-hmm. we cut tracks first, you know, most of the time. It was done with tracks first, and then once we got the feeling and we gave Eddie a melody to work from, then he would know some idea about what it is that we were feeling, Brian and I, when we sat down to do these things. In this particular case, Reach Out, I'll Be There, Brian came up with that initial da ba da da ba da ba da ba da da, and then it went into the funk part, as mm-hmm. I call it, and then. And then that's when I joined in. And we did a lot of things like that in compiling the track. And then once the track had been established, we would, share our feelings about the melody. And then after the melody and the idea and whatever title we had, then we would pass it on to Eddie so he could complete the lyrics.
I just find that so interesting because for so many other songwriters, it's the melody and the lyric that come first, and then the production's conceptualized.
You know, funny
you,
thing,
you're hearing all these instrumental
never knew
hooks
that.
First.
No one ever told us that.
So tell us a little more about how you worked together as a songwriting and production team, how you divided up the responsibilities and what the process was like.
Well, it started off, I guess, with sitting at the piano. This is Lamont. Started off at the piano with coming up with an idea first or a feeling of sorts. And then once we established that, Brian and I would work out a track that we wanted to cut or a feeling for a track, and we would go in and cut. Brian was the engineer. We both would put our feelings about the track and the music that we wanted to inject in the track and relay that to the musicians. Like, say, for instance, I Can't Help Myself as a bass line that dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Then I would pass that on to James Jamison while Brian was over telling Benny Benjamin what the feeling of the drum should be. This was the type of way we the workload, as I say, should that we distribute the workload, and then we pass that on to Eddie with any lyric or idea or title for him to complete the song.
At what point would you know what group was going to sing the song?
Well, this is Eddie Holland speaking. Well, pretty much we directed our attentions as a rule towards a specific group. For an example, if we were working on the Supremes, we would write specifically for the Supremes. If we were doing the Vandellas, we would write specifically for the Vandellas or the Four Tops or whatever. But Brian and Lamont were so very prolific in their coming up with melodies and ideas that very often they would do songs that didn't necessarily fit the particular artists that we were working on, meaning that they would come up with three songs and maybe two of the three or one of the three did not fit that particular artist that we were working towards, working, you know, on to get the production. So that song then would be diverted to another artist.
Can you think of an example like that?
Well, yes. I mean, in the process of coming up with songs for the Supremes, there was a song called This Old Heart of Mine that was later done on the Isley Brothers. You know, in the process of also working on, you know, the Supremes and or the Vandellas at that time, mm-hmm. there was a song called Baby, I Need Your Lovin', which later on was given to the Four Tops. So that is the examples of us working on a particular artist and then some of the songs being diverted to someone else.
My guests are the songwriting team of Brian and Eddie Holland and Lamont Dozier. Here's their song, This Old Heart of Mine, as recorded by the Isley Brothers. We'll be back with Holland, Dozier, and Holland after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are the songwriting team of Holland, Dozier, and Holland. They wrote most of the hits by the Supremes and the Four Tops and many other Motown hits as well. Let's hear another record. You did a lot of work with the Supremes. Some of the Supremes' hits that you wrote and produced include Where Did Our Love Go?, Baby Love, Come See About Me, Stop in the Name of Love, I Hear a Symphony, My World is Empty Without You, Love is Like an Itching in My Heart, Can't Hurry Love, You Keep Me Hanging On, etc., etc. So why don't we hear You Can't Hurry Love. Tell us about creating the song and creating the record, and then we'll hear it.
Brian came up with that. I remember correctly. Yeah, it was like a gospel thing. I guess you can't hurry love. A nice little bounce, and he came up with that idea and that feeling that just. At the time, the Supremes were riding high and filling their oats as superstars and what have you. And so it was like the next process in the scheme of thing, meaning that it was a hit song that a lot of artists couldn't have done, you know. But because of their popularity, we could get away with something like that with them, you know. So, again, we cut the track and passed that on to Eddie. I think that was, Eddie, he had to come up with a title for that.
I came up with the title for that. I was influenced by, Lamont hit it right on the head, by the way. This is Eddie. I was influenced by, I guess it's safe to say now, how many years has it been? the gospel songs. That's what influenced me. But to make it even clearer, what influenced me to be influenced by the gospel song was the melody and the beat of the song itself. The syncopated movement of the melody influenced me to think of that old gospel song, which I won't really say what it is, but all you gospel people out there, you know what it is.
Oh, what is it? Come on.
I'm not going to say
it. Oh, say it.
Nah, I'm not going to say it. But they'll know. You know who you are. Through the lyric, even in there, you could tell, you know, it was influenced. But see, because we grew up, Brian and I can't really speak for Lamont on that because I'm not sure. We never talked too much about that. But Brian and I, you know, we grew up in the church at a very, very young age. Hearing of Sunday school, a school period, I thought it was Sunday school. You know, that's the first school I knew was Sunday school that I could retain. You know, that's the truth. So we grew up in a Baptist church, you know, Davison Avenue Baptist Church in Detroit, Michigan there on St. Auburn. A lot of the songs, I was influenced by what influenced me in the church.
I think that was why we got along so well, because we had the same sort of same musical upbringing, classical music mixed with gospel music. And in my particular case, I couldn't get out the house unless I go to choir rehearsal with her.
You too. we finally found out. Huh?
Yeah. You know, and that was a must, you know, in the black home in those days. My grandmother was a choir instructor, and I had to be there for choir rehearsals on Thursdays and then all day Sunday, and maybe sometimes on Saturdays, you know, with this choir business. From the time I was 12 years old, learning about harmonies and singing in the choir and things like that. So I learned quite a bit, and I think we all did, because it was like the backbone of most black singers today, from Aretha Franklin, who is a good friend of ours that that we knew back there, and a lot of other other people that we knew at Motown, exactly, that grew up in church. Marvin Gaye was another church boy, you know. And most of our training came from church. So when you say songwriting is done this way or that way, we just shot from the hip. Whatever felt good, that's what we did.
Well, let's hear one of your many records that turned out great. This is the Supremes' You Can't Hurry Love. Supremes, You Can't Hurry Love, one of the many songs written and produced by the team of Holland, Dozier, and Holland, and they are getting the BMI Icon Award in May, and so we wish them congratulations, and my guests are Holland, Dozier, and Holland, and we're talking about their years with Motown and their many songs that they wrote and produced. So many of your hit songs have catchphrase titles like You Can't Hurry Love, or Reach Out, I'll Be There, Sugar Pie Honey Bun, Nothing But Heartaches, You Keep Me Hanging On. Eddie, you wrote a lot of the lyrics, or all of the lyrics. Is there a reason why those phrases would come to you as song titles?
Well, no. That Sugar Pie Honey Bunch thing was Lamont.
And I got it from my grandfather. he used to call it.
That's for sure.
Yeah, he got that from, you know, in the South. They had those catchphrases, being that my grandfather was from the South. He used to come, and we had my grandmother had a home shop, a beauty shop. And all the women used to come into the shop, and he'd be working in the front garden, and he sort of would be flirting with them, and he was like, "How you doing, Miss Carrie, Sugar Pie Honey Bunch?" You know, flirting with them, and my grandmother used to be watching from the door. Said, "Look at that old codger out there." And the thing is, a lot of the things like that came back to when it came time for me to use some of those catchphrases. They came back just when we needed something to say and to fit a certain track or whatever. In this case, that's what it was.
Yeah, but mostly I would use titles. This is Eddie speaking again. That you know, that had some meaning. You know, I would try to do something titled, use titles that I felt had appeal from an emotional point of view. And a lot of the titles were things that were said to me that I had direct personal experiences in dealing with, you know. You know, I was a young man and
a little sweetheart or two.
You know, so a lot of the so a lot of the titles would be actually titles that females, the ladies, you know, I would say nice ladies
would say
to me. Sometimes out of anger, sometimes out of whatever, you know. So a lot of that, but you could hear something that had feeling, you could hear something that had meaning, and I basically believed in using titles and ideas that had feeling or appealed to them.
Wait, so did you have a girlfriend who said, "You don't really love me, you just keep me hanging on"?
Well, I had a lot of them that said that, to say the least. But that was an argument that I had, you know, with someone that they said that to me, yes.
And you were taking notes.
Well, you know what? When you're a creative person, you don't necessarily, it just sticks to you. You went, as soon as you hear it, it catches you right away. And for some reason, all your instincts, you know, you could be in the middle of an argument or, you know, I've been on telephones and talking to females in different conversations, you know. And sometimes they would say certain things. I'd say, "Well, hold on for a minute," and I would go get me a pencil, and I would write it down, you know, because it's just being a creative person, especially knowing that your responsibility is doing the lyric, and you doing the lyric with two very, very prolific, you know, meaning Brian Lamont, very, very prolific songwriters. You have to constantly, you have to think it and feel it and live it all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, it's a natural thing. I think all songwriters are like that, or poets are like that. You know, they hear something, they jot it down. Either if they don't jot it down, then they take mental notes, and it sticks. You know, I've had titles in my head that I've had for 25 years. I have titles in my head now that I've had for 25 years. That it's just ideas and thoughts. You know, it just stick. You just stand out. You know.
Brian and Eddie Holland and Lamont Dozier will be back in the second half of the show. They'll receive the BMI Icon Award tomorrow at BMI's annual Pop Awards dinner. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of On the Nature of Human Romantic Interaction, fictional stories by Carl Yanyema. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Through the mirror of my mind, time after time.
Coming up, more songs and stories from Holland, Dozier, and Holland. And we remember Elizabeth Newfer, a reporter for the Boston Globe, who covered several wars. She was killed Friday in a car accident in Iraq, where she was covering the aftermath of the war.
I'm all alone now, no love to shield me. Trapped in a world that's a distorted reality. Happiness you took from me and left me alone with only men.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the songwriting team of Holland, Dozier & Holland. Lamont Dozier, along with brothers Brian and Eddie Holland, wrote most of the hits recorded by the Supremes and the Four Tops, and wrote many other Motown hits as well. They will receive the BMI Icon Award tomorrow at the BMI Annual Pop Awards Dinner. How are you meshed with the Supremes? How did the Supremes become one of your groups?
I don't know. I guess they became one of the groups when we had the best song of the rest of the producers. Meaning that, case in point, there were. Yeah, this is Lamont speaking, right? case in point, I think we first started recording them of any consequence. We had a big hit or a top 20 hit. When the love light starts shining in his eyes, which did okay, but they became our group, so to speak, when we came up with Where Did Our Love Go? And Where Did Our Love Go? Was something that by accident happened that could have been just as well for the Marvelettes or people like that. But because it was a big hit on the Supremes, in this particular case, the song was so big that Barry came in and said, hey, we got to follow this up. And that's when we started doing more baby stuff, baby love, baby this, baby that.
But only thing about it, with Lamont, I talked to Barry Gordy on one night on the porch of Motown, and he said, listen, he said, I talked to Barney. Barney said, Barney Ailes, he's the guy, you know, was heading of sales at that time and handling distributors. He said, the record is a smash, it's a big record. And he says, we need to hurry up and do more on the Supremes and because Motown needs to go all out on making the Supremes a big group. He said, because they have big crossover potential. And so when I heard that, I went back and told Brian Lamont. I said, listen, we have to move on this group because the company has the intent of being very strongly behind this group. And so what we have to do is come up with some other songs on the group because, you know, it's a very competitive company here. And so we did that. And I don't know whether they remember once I came in there and I told them that nobody was leaving out of here. I don't know if they remember that. No. I closed the office door and they said they're going, they were leaving. I said, no, man, nobody's leaving out of this office. We coming up with some songs. Lamont looked at me, Brian looked. And then so the fact of the matter is the next three number one or top ten or whatever the songs that I don't recall now was done that day.
That's right.
And Brian and I got into an argument, what should be the next follow-up or what should be this follow-up. That's the only argument. All three of those songs were done that day on the next session.
Which songs were they?
Baby Love and Come See About Me.
Right. And it was another one,
too. It's another one, too, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Baby Love, Come See About Me, and then...
Got him back in my arms.
It was something else that was... Yeah. But whatever, maybe it was just the two. I thought it was three. But if those two songs was done on the same session, when they were recorded that day, and then, like I said, Brian and I got into an argument. He and I argued a lot. Lamont sort of looked and eased his way out. Out of the office. He was always very smart not to get involved. Two brothers arguing.
He brothers fight it out.
Two bargains arguing out. You know, he just say, hey, whoever wins, I'm on your side. You know, he's a real politician. You know what I mean? That was the position that he took.
Well,
but anyway.
Why don't we hear the song that kicked all of that off and hear the Supremes doing Where Did Our Love Go? Written and produced by my guests, the team of Holland, Dozier, and Holland.
Baby, don't leave me. Ooh, please don't leave me.
The Supremes doing the Holland, Dozier, and Hollett song, Where Did Our Love Go? Brian and Eddie Holland and Lamont Dozier will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are the songwriting team of Holland, Dozier, and Holland. They wrote most of the hits by the Supremes and the Four Tops, and many other Motown hits as well. Brian Holland, you were vice president for quality control at Motown. What did that mean?
That meant that I would take the records, the records that were being mixed, I would take them and listen to them and see, did it have the quality to go out on the street? Mm-hmm. And if it was not the quality I thought it should be, or I thought Berry Gordy would want, then I would reject it and have it redone again.
Not the greatest way of making friends. Did you get into a lot of fights?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I remember specifically I got into, not a fight, you know what I mean? We got a disagreement with a couple producers because I turned down whatever thing they thought was hits and said, no, it wasn't good enough to go out.
Now, did you have other ways of testing it? You know, were there meetings in which you played it for everybody else at Motown, or were there dances that you could test a record before mm-hmm. it was released commercially to see if it was infectious or not?
Yeah, well, this is Brian again, as you know. What had happened is that we had what they call a quality control meeting, and to listen to all the records that was scheduled to go out, and we would vote on them. We have about maybe 8 to 10 people that would actually vote on a record. And if they say the majority say yay, then it goes out.
And personally, I always, this is Eddie, personally, I always thought it was more of a popularity contest more than anything, because nobody was going to say no on Smokey Robinson's songs for the most part. or Berry Gordy's either.
I remember, too, every once, and this is Lamont, every once in a while we had some kids come in the big studio. Well, big studio, it wasn't a big studio, but in the main studio that we recorded, and we would have chips, Coke and chips. Coca-Cola, that is, and chips, and had the kids come in. I remember one summer we did that. We had an onslaught of songs, and I think Mickey Stevenson had sort of got some kids together off the street or whatever, and brought them into the studio, and we had a little listening party. And they played these songs, and a lot of the kids would express their opinion on what they felt. They danced to the songs and gave opinions on them, and made little cards and jot down what they liked.
Did you ever disagree with them and think, oh, what do you know anyways? You're just a kid. I'm a professional songwriter, and I know better.
Well, this is Brian speaking. We did that. He's right. We did that on several occasions, but it proved not to be good. For one, Smokey Robinson, he and Berry used to get into it all the time about his records. And he would demand that Berry bring in a whole bunch of kids and to test his records out. And the kids, Smokey was so popular that they said, yeah. And they put the record out and then it flopped. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a good, that proved not to be a good choice. The older people, the more, I would say, the 25 to 30 to 40 people we had in the quality control meetings proved to be the most accurate of releasing records.
Yeah, uh-huh. And they were both reliable because they got into the song, got into the feeling of the situation, and the lyric, and and just the overall production. Then there were times when Barry would just override everything, when everybody said, no, it was a flop or whatever they thought. And he would say, well, I'm putting this out anyway, or I'm not putting it out. Now, he would override the whole situation at times.
What's the biggest disagreement you had in-house with Berry Gordy or other people in quality control over whether one of your records was good enough?
Well, I don't think we had, but I know Smokey, Brian, and you were talking about, you really got a hold on me. Barry didn't think that was so great.
Great record.
Well, none of us thought that was really great. We were trying to figure out what had happened, in the studio with Smokey. And Smokey just said, no, this is a top 10. And he was right. He proved it.
Did you change your mind, or do you still think it's mediocre?
No comment.
But also, Edward, we had a Smokey had a disagreement with one of our records.
Reach out,
I'll be there.
Smokey, he didn't like it. This is Eddie, mm-hmm. And I was in the quality control meeting that particular day. I remember that Smokey. I looked at him, and he said, "Well, I don't like the record. It's kind of." I don't hear it. It's kind of a strange kind of record. And then we went, and I remember, and then Barry looked and asked a couple other people. Nobody could get into that Reach Out, I'll Be There.
Hmm.
And Barry looked. He said, well, all I know is that it's unique, and I never heard a record like this. And so he, being a creative person, I think he gambled on, knowing it was a little odd, sounded a little odd, but I think what he did was gamble on the fact of the creativity he thought was astounding. And then, to make matters worse, I mean, I still kind of held that in the back of my mind when I heard, watch that. We went into the studio to dub in the Four Tops, and the individual that handled their harmonies, what was his name?
Lawrence
Payton. He listened to it, and I said, what do you think? He said, it's a little strange. That was his comment. So I figured that was another way of him being politely saying, I don't like it.
It turned out great. One of the things that I think makes it distinctive and might have also made it sound strange is the huh. Yeah. I sound silly when I do that, but you know what I'm talking about.
Well, you sounded pretty good. That's right.
So who came up with that?
That was something collaborated. Type of thing that we all just sort of agreed on. I was in the studio, Lissa Lamont, with the guys, and we were thinking about different ways to fill in, because the song was different and the way it moved and going from one section to another. There are certain spots you wanted to enhance the feeling of the song. Mm-hmm. So you put in, certain things like that that we had to do to sort of add to the feeling of the song to give it more of a oomph, you know.
Well, we'd have time just to end with one more recording, and I thought we'd play the Martha and the Vandellas hit Heat Wave, which you wrote and produced. Brian, is there a story behind the song?
Well, it was a successful song. That's the main story, but not much of a story other than we had fun doing that song, and it took a lot of editing work I had to do on that song.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Right.
A lot of tape on the floor.
What kind of editing?
Well, just like when you're going to edit this tape, I guess, maybe to some degree. But you had to take out little parts that you didn't need, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And to make the song whole.
Yeah.
Okay.
To keep the
intensity.
The energy.
Right,
the
energy.
Intensity
right,
up.
Going.
Yeah,
right.
Right. You have to do that sometimes. Sometimes a lot of lull in the song. You know,
right.
Meaning that it a lot of wasted air, time, or maybe. And then you only had, in those days, like 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes long. In those days, so you had to make sure that you hit all the hot spots and keep the energy up.
It was a very high energy song.
It was that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And a big hit for them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And for us, too.
Well, listen, congratulations on your BMI award. Thank you so much for talking with us. It was really fun, and thanks for all the great music you've given us.
Thank you.
Thank you,
it's been a pleasure.
Something inside.
Brian and Eddie Holland and Lamont Dozier will receive the BMI Icon Award tomorrow at BMI's annual Pop Awards dinner. Coming up, we remember Boston Globe reporter Elizabeth Newfer. She was killed in Iraq in a car accident. This is Fresh Air. We were very sad to hear that Elizabeth Newfer, a reporter for the Boston Globe, was killed in a car accident on Friday in Iraq, where she was covering the aftermath of the war. She's the 13th journalist to die in Iraq since the war began. She was returning to Baghdad from Tikrit, where she was researching a story, when the car she was in blew a tire and slammed into a guardrail. Her translator was also killed. The driver survived. We called Washington Post reporter Peter Slevin in Baghdad. He was Newfer's friend and was called to the scene of the accident. What story was she working on?
She was working on a story on the Ba'ath Party, the ruling party in Iraq under Saddam Hussein's era. She had found some remarkable documents at a Ba'ath Party headquarters that detailed how the party itself snooped on Iraqis and intimidated them. She thought it would work particularly well if she went to Tikrit, which is up the road. It's Saddam Hussein's hometown and a Ba'ath Party stronghold, to write about the current nominal mayor of this town, who is a former Ba'ath Party player, Ba'ath Party figure. And she intended to write that and alongside the story on the documents that she found. She had hoped before leaving the country in a couple of weeks to do a story on the process of de-Ba'athification, the idea that the old party needed to go, and the difficulties of figuring out who was good and who was bad, and how Iraq would move forward after the legacy of the party.
Had you been traveling with her?
I had not been traveling with her. I ran into Elizabeth when we separately found ourselves in Najaf, the Shiite holy city south of Baghdad. She was working on a story on the Hausa, who are religious figures very important in Shiite culture and perhaps increasingly important in the politics of Baghdad. It was a funny scene because I was waiting to talk to the mayor, the new mayor of Najaf, and I saw a woman in an abaya, a black cloak that women are required to wear in the holy sites. And something didn't quite compute, and someone said, "Peter." And I realized it was Elizabeth. I thought maybe it was a Catholic nun, perhaps, coming to offer some aid. But she was wearing what she needed to wear to do the story.
Well, Peter, we're all very sorry, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm glad to talk.
Peter Slevin speaking to us from Baghdad. Those of us at Fresh Air had become great admirers of Elizabeth Newfer. She'd been our guest three times in the past few months, talking about her reporting from Iran and Iraq, and her earlier work covering Bosnia and Rwanda, which was the subject of her book, The Key to My Neighbor's House. She had also covered the first Gulf War and the war on terrorism in Afghanistan. Our first interview was recorded last December. She had just completed boot camp for journalists reporting from war zones. She was preparing to go to Iraq. I asked her about the possibility of being exposed to weapons of mass destruction. I wanted to know if she found that prospect terrifying.
I'm always terrified when I go into a war zone. I mean, people sometimes think I'm a glutton for punishment, but I do always find that the stories of the people who will be there, the citizens, and who are in fact unprepared for these kinds of disasters, are always just extraordinarily compelling. They're usually worth the risk.
No, we were talking about how one of the role-playing things you did during this boot camp for journalists entering war zones is that you were abducted in a role-playing scenario.
Right.
Have you ever been abducted in real life while covering a war?
I was hijacked, I guess would be the way to put it. I had an incident occur in Bosnia. Imagine it's the height of the war. There's intense shelling. It's dark at night. A colleague and I are up on Mount Igman. We can watch the city being bombed below, and we're attempting to drive out. We're driving a heavily armored car. The road is slippery. It's rainy. It's a dirt track. Our car slips in the mud and basically falls into a ditch. We climb out. It's an exceedingly heavy car, and we can't get it out of the ditch. Unfortunately, the people we flag down are extraordinarily drunk soldiers, and they proceed to sort of take the car battery to try to harass us. They surround my colleague with guns. One of them starts pawing me rather intensely, and it becomes pretty clear at a certain point that rape can be a real option. It was a rather nasty experience and kind of a horrible realization at the time.
How did you get through to the other end on that one?
Well, just sort of one of those moments of insight that in fact what these guys probably were more interested in was the car than they were me. So I spoke a little bit of Bosnian. I kept talking to them again. I kept trying to humanize myself. I kept saying, hi, I'm a journalist. This man is my husband. He wasn't, but he was convenient for the time. And, here's our car. Can you help us fix it? Eventually handed the car keys over. And they got very distracted with the idea of getting this car out of the ditch. And once they took their hands off me, we grabbed the satellite telephone and ran and found our way to a UN soldier and a tank and had literally just set up the satellite telephone and were radioing for help and whatever could happen and watched our car drive by us. Vroom! And saying, whoops, because now it's like 2 a.m. and we have to hitchhike off of Mount Igman in the middle of a terrible shelling raid. But in fact, we were able to hitchhike off of Mount Igman and we did get down to safety. And eventually the car, in fact, was recovered from these particular thugs. So it all ended very happily.
Is there a story that you've told that has had the biggest impact, that you feel really good about?
Well, I'd have to, again, refer back to the key to my neighbor's house. I was really haunted by some of the people I covered in Bosnia and Rwanda, and that's why I chose to take time off and to write the book. So the two stories I feel most strongly about are Hasan Nuhanovic, and I told his story at various points throughout the Bosnian War. Hasan is a survivor of Srebrenica, the UN safe area that was overrun by Bosnian Serb troops. 8,000 Bosnian men and boys were slaughtered. Hasan survived, but he lost his family. And a series of stories I answered a lot of questions for him about sort of who had pulled the trigger and why. And that was kind of a pretty neat thing to be able to do. The second story is, again, witness JJ, this remarkable woman I met in Rwanda. After the genocide, I told her story, along with that of other women, of how they were willing to come forward and talk about their rape. Just an extraordinary set of accounts, particularly in conservative Rwanda, where women rarely talk about issues of sex. And wrote that story. And when I returned, I guess 3 or 4 years later, I found that, in fact, Witness JJ, and you notice I'm calling her Witness JJ and not by her name, had gone on to be a lead witness at the UN War Crimes Tribunal. And in fact, it's due to her testimony that rape is now considered to be an act of genocide. That is a historical first for women.
What did she say and what was the importance of it?
She went in front of the tribunal and basically looked the man in the eye who had ordered the rapes. His name was Jean-Paul Akayesu. He was the mayor of her village, of Taba. And she gave extraordinary testimony about how Akayesu, as he was discussing the women, turned to one of the Hutu Interahamwe, the sort of Hutu thugs, and said, "Never ask me again what a Tutsi woman tastes like," a reference to the fact that the women had just been raped, and then added, you know, "because tomorrow they will all be killed." It was that particular set of phrases, just, you know, the courtroom was just dead silent at the sort of gall that this man had to sort of talk about these women's rape and then basically order them to be killed the next day.
And where is he now?
Behind bars for life.
A question that's come up is, should journalists have to testify at war crimes tribunals about the information that they have? Is there information you would voluntarily give up to the war crimes tribunal because you didn't think it would hurt hurt victims that it might help get justice?
Yeah. No, it's obviously my company's decision whether or not they want me to testify or whether or not they want me to turn information over. But there was a time when I led war crimes investigators to a mass grave. They wouldn't have found it otherwise. And I didn't see that it was any dereliction of duty. I happened to be in the neighborhood. I had just stumbled on it. It was clear that it needed to be safeguarded, that it needed to be exhumed, that it was an important piece of evidence. And so I, you know, said, "Hey, follow me, you know, we'll show you where it is." I didn't feel that that compromised me in any way as a journalist. You know, by the sheer fact of the reporting we did, a lot of the reporting we did in Bosnia, in fact, helped the War Crimes Tribunal. So I think that it's, you know, we end up often chasing the same things.
Elizabeth Neufer recorded last December. Neufer was a reporter for the Boston Globe. She was killed in a car accident Friday in Iraq while covering the aftermath of the war. She was 46. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the Internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the CIA's covert funding of the Afghan Mujahideen in their war against the Soviet Union. We'll hear from 60 Minutes producer George Kreil, who's written a book about the operation, and from Charlie Wilson, the Texas congressman who worked with a CIA operative to help fund the jihad. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.